I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind the people bringing science to society. From challenges to opportunities, we uncover the impact of research on policy, community, and ultimately, you. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap. Today we are here with the Vice President of Research and Innovation at Dalhousie University, Dr. Alice Aiken.
Hi.
Alice, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I have been the Vice President for Research and Innovation here at Dal since 2017. Prior to that, I was the Dean of Health for a little over a year, and prior to that, I was at Queen's University.
Very cool. Very cool.
I never knew that you were at Queen's University before. I don't know why. I think whenever I think of, you know, higher up administrative roles, I always think everyone was from Dal and like kind of worked their way up. I think just from the people I know and Sean.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really interesting.
And is Queen's University, is that the one in Kingston?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
My brother was just there and he's staying there. He's working with the National Youth Orchestra.
Oh,
and
cool.
They're, like, setting up to go on tour, but they're getting prepared at Queen's right now.
Oh, wow.
So, anyways.
Yeah, there's a big music school there.
Yeah. And apparently it's the oldest university in Canada.
Nope, we're older.
Oh, we're older. Mm. Okay, well, Felix just got incorrect information. I was going to say, Dalhousie's quite old.
Yeah, we're 205.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
And Forest was the first building, right?
It was.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It feels like that
sometimes.
That's
where I went to school, too. Yeah,
it's a nice building. All right, so on our podcast, we have a fun little segment. So this is a Would You Rather research topic edition. So which of the following topics would you rather research? And these are projects that have already been done. So unfortunately, can't get into it now. So option number one, can pigeons tell a Picasso from a Monet? Or option two, even chickens prefer beautiful people.
I would pick option two.
Option two, even chickens prefer beautiful people. All right, so this was from a paper, Chickens Prefer Beautiful Humans. A study saw that six chickens trained to react to images of ordinary male or female faces. Then they were tested on a series of images ranging from an average face to a face with exaggerated male or female characteristics. And a group of 14 students were given the same test. And then, surprisingly, the chickens showed preferences for faces consistent with human sexual preferences.
Wow.
And this is evidence for the hypothesis that human preferences stem not from face-specific adaptations, but from general properties of the nervous system. Huh.
Interesting.
That's a very
I far can't
leap.
Believe they could compare students and chickens.
I know. Who would have guessed? And then the pigeon one was published in 1995, called Pigeons: Discrimination of Paintings by Monet and Picasso. And yeah, I guess they looked at pigeons. So this paper presents evidence that pigeons are indeed able to distinguish between works of the two artists. It's kind of...
And are these the same papers that, like, they've won awards?
No, these two did not.
We had some in the past that you would think are really out there, and they have won Nobel Prizes for their work.
Oh, wow. Nobel Prizes. Apparently there's this Ig Nobel Prize, which is, like, a Nobel Prize for, like, generating humor, I guess.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Like, it's kind of like a feel-good.
Like a something that makes you think and then
laugh and then think, something like that.
Yeah.
Well, super different styles and colors, like, right? Picasso's are very bold and bright.
Mm-hmm.
Monet's are very gentle and...
Yes.
So I wonder if that's...
It does say, though, that these birds were trained to recognize the pieces.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah. It also, the research, there's a quote in here that just says the research does not deal with advanced artistic judgments.
They're not. So you can't compare it to the artistic judgments of a connoisseur of art.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So that's the would you rather. Some fun little research topics. But now into the questions. So Alice, could you give us a recap on all the major milestones you've accomplished in your research journey? So starting from your bachelor's and moving on to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. So I actually had a pretty atypical journey to the academy. I started my Bachelor of Science degree, well, kinesiology, mm-hmm. at the University of Ottawa. And the summer before that, I actually joined the Navy, the Canadian Navy.
Okay.
And so I did that through my first degree. And then I went and worked full time in the Navy. And I realized I wanted to go back to school, so I applied for physiotherapy at Dalhousie because I was posted out here, and I got in, and I did my physiotherapy degree here, and the military continued to employ me as a physiotherapist, and I ended up getting posted to Kingston, Ontario. And from there, after I had paid back my time to the military, I was releasing and I went to Queen's University to actually run their physio clinic. They were opening, wow, a physio clinic right in the school. So part of that was I got a tuition benefit. So I did my master's and my PhD part-time while I was working full-time at Queen's.
Nice.
And then started as a faculty member at Queen's. So I didn't actually postdoc because by that time I had 12 years of clinical, yes, experience and go full time and going into an academic position in a physiotherapy program. So there were quite a few openings around the country and at that time, and I had a lot of options, but Queen's really suited my research, mm-hmm, at that time. Mm-hmm. So I ended up staying there as a faculty member for 10 years until I came to Dalhousie.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is definitely atypical.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very cool. I think it's pretty unique to have both sides, the actual clinical work, mm-hmm, and then also doing research on, yeah, top of that.
Yeah.
And it's, then, yeah.
It's nice that you were able to continue doing the clinical work. Because I feel like from other now researchers, you know, they were able to do a couple years and then they go right into research. So it's nice that you have that like large background of clinical practice to accompany the research.
Yeah, I mean, it was very, very helpful, you know, teaching in a physio program and helping our students. And yeah, just having that background was enormously helpful. You know, my research is, I work all in health services and health policy. So it's, yes, not directly related to physiotherapy, but I had a lot of clinical experience. So I was able to rely on that for my teaching, not, yeah, my research so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that's very cool. Yeah. I've always thought about going into physiotherapy. I think it's a very rewarding sort of job that you can get. And it's like a nice second step after doing a kinesiology degree also.
Yeah. 'Cause
you get like such a good foundation and then you, can put your foundation into practice. So, mm-hmm, it is really cool. I've seriously considered it for a while, but I don't know. There's something about research that just draws
pulls
me
you
in.
Back in.
Yeah. So, yeah. Haven't directly gone down that way.
I wouldn't have get, like when I was doing my PhD part-time, I really thought I would stay as a clinician scientist,
mm-hmm,
but I completely fell in love with my research and went into a tenure track, mm-hmm, faculty position.
Very
and
cool.
I did a bit of part-time clinical practice for about 2 years after I started, but then it did get too busy.
Yeah. 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 What kind of research were you doing at that time?
So my initial research was all around the role of the advanced practice physio in orthopedics.
Okay.
So, you know, in the health system you have a neurologist and a neurosurgeon and a cardiologist and a cardiac surgeon and nobody in an orthopedic surgeon. So, mm-hmm, these surgeons are using a lot of their time in clinics and stuff that, you know, the other health professional who can do that for sure is a physiotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
And so my initial research was all comparing clinical diagnoses by physiotherapists and orthopedic surgeons compared to a gold standard, like an ultrasound or an MRI or something.
Mm.
And a skilled physiotherapist and an orthopedic surgeon are equally good,
oh,
at,
wow,
clinical diagnoses. Mm. So that did a lot of, it helped with a lot of confidence in the area. And then we looked specifically at hip and knee replacements and decreasing the wait times by putting physios into the pipeline and taking out the people who didn't need to be there or hadn't received the right information and, you know, prioritizing the people who did need surgery almost immediately. So it worked very well in Kingston for reducing the wait times.
Wow.
So, yeah. And that advanced practice model went right across Canada.
Oh, wow.
To every province except Nova Scotia.
And I was going to say our wait times. I do know because I've had hip surgery. They are long.
They're long. And it's called the Kingston model. Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. Yeah. See, the one thing that I feel like I have yet to get in my research journey is the seeing the translation of the research into the real world. So that must be like such a good feeling.
Yeah, I mean, there was actually at the time, because we were really focused on the role of the advanced practice physio, there was actually legislated scope of practice changes, by the government of Ontario. Mm-hmm. And so my research was sort of part of the background for that. And then other people started researching it as well, but Alberta changed their regulations. And so it led to a broadening of scope of practice for physiotherapists as well. So yeah, it was really, it was very, very rewarding.
Yeah. Hopefully, like 40 years down the line, I'll see it. You know?
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of Juliet and I attended as guests the Societal Impact of Science.
Yes, I believe.
I know you were responsible for bringing them here.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that, just seeing your research go into practice.
Yes.
Because I feel like us coming from more of a basic research foundation being funded by NSERC, we don't always see that.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's interesting is because I'm starting in my second 5-year term as the vice president, research and innovation, we're refreshing our research strategy. And we've gone around, we're talking outside of DAL, but also inside of DAL. And we've had big sessions with students and profs and researchers, research staff. And what we're hearing this time, and this is really post-pandemic, because obviously we did this 5 years ago when I started as well and really engaged the community in our strategy. And there's a huge focus now on impact. Mm-hmm. People really want to understand the impact of their research. Mm-hmm. And we're hearing it in a way that we just didn't hear it last time. But I think we probably realized through the pandemic that some of the research that we were as scientists able to go, okay, well, that makes sense. That's why the information on vaccines is changing, whatever. Some people just didn't believe it. They're like, well, you're telling us one thing one day and one thing the other. Yeah. They didn't understand science. And I blame us. I blame academics for not communicating effectively and talking about the impact of our work. Mm-hmm. And so I think people, for me now, really hearing it, and right across our research community, it's not just in health, we're hearing it in our clean tech, we're hearing it in our food security, we're hearing it in our ocean folks. So it's really quite interesting. It's a big change.
Yeah, I think it's a good change for sure. It's good that we're now starting to really focus on impact.
Yeah.
I do wonder sometimes, like those mathematicians out there who are like trying to solve this one mathematical problem, like how they go about it. But I've heard that for funding applications, they say, we don't know exactly how this will help, but in the future, it will help with something. And I think that is equally as impactful in some regard.
Yeah, look, you need the basic research. Yeah. So, I mean, messenger RNA vaccines, everybody thought, oh, they're new for COVID. I don't trust them. They've been around for 30 years, right?
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't new technology at all. And that was based on 30 years of basic science.
Exactly.
You absolutely need fundamental research as well. Even if you can't see what the endpoint's going to be, that's why people do research, is knowing that somewhere down the line it'll have impact.
Exactly, exactly.
I don't know about chickens recognizing pain, so I'm still struggling with that one.
Thinking the pigeons and stuff, like maybe, who knows?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, the overall idea that came out of that, where it's like, these face-specific adaptations, it's actually maybe more universal. That's kind of cool, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
But maybe not super surprising.
So you mentioned you were in the military in yes. your little major milestone recap we just had you go through. We saw on your Dalhousie page that you are the co-founder of the Canadian Institute for Military and Veteran mm-hmm. Health Research. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when I was working at Queen's, I was approached by a retired general who was on the hospital board, and he had been my base commander when I was still in. And he sort of, it was right during the height of the Gulf War. And so we were mm-hmm. seeing people come home injured and, or having paid the ultimate price. And there was an awareness and a conscious awareness of the role the military played in the country in kind of a way there hadn't been in many years. And he said, you know, we've got Queen's here, we've got RMC, we've got a big base. Is there something we can do? You know, we're an academic health sciences center. And so we then reached out to the incoming Surgeon General, and the Surgeon General and I really ran with this. The military Surgeon General is a man named Commodore Hans Jung at that time. And we sort of really ran with this, and we had a conference. We got a bunch of the universities engaged, because what they realized is they needed much more capacity to do research about the health needs of the military. So physical health, mental health, well-being, family health. And we were able to bring the academic community together around this. We started with a conference, and after our first conference, 15 universities signed on. And we actually grew it to be really the largest organization of its kind in the world. And so we're 48 Canadian, they are now 48, when I left, 48 Canadian universities and 13 international partners. We launched a research journal that's indexed now, the Journal for Military, Veteran, and Family Health. And they run the largest conference of its kind in the world as well, focused on military and veteran and family health. And what was really neat is we were able to bring our international partners together and said, look, our militaries are different. They train differently. They deploy differently. They wear different clothes, eat different food. Mm-hmm. They come back. When they release into a different health system and a different social system. But if we're doing studies, maybe we can share methodologies and really figure out what's, you know, have some universal guidance around what's working and not working for military, veteran, and family health. And so, yeah, it was really interesting. It was absolutely a labor of love, but we grew it, you know, really convinced the federal government, National Defense and Veterans Affairs, that they should work with the academic community. And so, you know, at some point I was on speed dial for 4 consecutive ministers of Veterans Affairs, right? They got the message that you can do your own research, but if it's not what the public wants to hear, they're not going to believe you.
Yeah.
But if an independent academic has done that work, then suddenly, you know, it's really beyond reproach.
Yeah.
So it was really fascinating. And my own work, my own research, I worked with a research team. And you know, every province has large health administrative databases, mm-hmm. the biggest one being in Ontario because it's the biggest province. And we actually found the veteran identifier in the health database in Ontario. So it was the first cohort data of veterans that we were ever able to find, right? That everything else is cross-sectional, because in Canada, when you release from the military, you don't automatically become a client of Veterans Affairs. You're only a client of Veterans Affairs if you were injured in service. It's not like other militaries. So essentially, they provide additional health insurance for you if you've been injured in service. So there was no way to track veterans. And so we found this massive database, and we were really able to do some incredible predictions about negative health effects of service, but also positive health effects of service, right? Because you have a good, secure job. It's well paid. You know, a lot of determinants of health are part of that as well. And we're still doing research on that data. We've been asking, we found it in 2012, maybe 2011, something like that. And we've been asking the Ontario Health Data folks to make it public, like saying, make this a regular part of your data. You know, we've got 40,000 some odd veterans. We've now built an administrative cohort so we can do comparators. We found the military family identifier. So we were able to do a bunch of family predictions. And they haven't made any of it public yet. So we're still publishing like crazy on all that data.
Wow. It's so much more involved than I even like had any
could have imagined.
Yeah, yeah. Could have imagined.
Yeah.
Wow.
That sounds like very, very impactful.
Yeah.
Work.
And important.
Yeah.
Impactful and important for sure.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to see just like you see the need for something and then you put your resources together and then you get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't know, I think it's one of the most fulfilling parts of being a part of like academia or research because you don't have to wait to be told to do something, right? You can look, see a need for something and like really just go for it. And in this case, it seems like the surgical, I don't want to get his title wrong.
What?
The guy who brought up the idea with you.
Oh, the Surgeon General.
Yeah, the Surgeon General.
My former base commander and then the Surgeon General,
Yeah, really got things going.
Yeah, very supportive. And so, you know, he brought the military to the table and I was able to bring the academic community to the table and it worked very well. And
it's crazy because it's like all that data was sitting there. It just took someone to go and find it, right?
Well, that's my own research team. So the research that's being done really crosses the board. There's mortality studies. There's mental health studies. There's well-being studies. There's analysis of all of the sexual misconduct data that has all been public.
Mm.
There's advanced surgical techniques that came out of Afghanistan. You know, one of the lasting results out of Afghanistan is some really advanced trauma surgery techniques. So that's some of the stuff we were able to bring to the forefront for the military surgeons who were working there. You know, so it's really everything from physical health, mental health, family health, well-being, moral injury. So my research is a tiny, tiny part of it. The research being done now across Canada and coordinated through the Canadian Institute for Military and Veteran Health Research is massive. I mean, there's over 1,000 researchers just across Canada doing research in military and veteran health.
It's very, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I know one researcher in PhD in health who's studying the impact of pottery on veterans and
transitioning. She's my PhD student.
I was gonna say
I met her. I think you've met her before. I met her at the conference. Yes.
I remember going into conversation with her because I met her on my first orientation day here at Dal, and I was like, "Oh, have you ever read the book A Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl?" And she's like, I named my dog after him.
Yes, you have.
Because it's very similar. The book is all about the transition after he survived the concentration camps. And so it's a very about like transitioning back into normal society kind of, and the struggles that come with that and also the hopes and stuff like that. So anyways, I was like, I hit the mark on that one. Happy I asked that question.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of research, we were hoping you could give us a little bit of an elevator pitch of the roles and responsibilities of the Vice President of Research and Innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will preface this by saying it's the best job in the entire university. Everybody's heard me say that. I absolutely love what I do. So basically, we oversee the research enterprise for the entire university. So I have three teams. The first is the Office of Research Services, and they help manage all of the regular granting opportunities, like through NSERC, CIHR, SHRC, CFI, and other sort of standard granting agencies. They help coordinate and manage all those grants, help ensure that we know what's going in, that people are getting everything in on time, we're meeting the deadlines, we advertise, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
My second team is the Office of Commercialization and Industry Engagement. So we also have industry partners who do research with us or fund research at Dal.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have researchers who want to commercialize their ideas.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that office helps with all of that. And we have an intellectual property expert there and all of that. And then the third team is one that has just been around for about 5 years. This is built since I came into this role. And that's our innovation and entrepreneurship suite of programming. We call it DAL Innovates. Mm. You can go see it, dalinnovates.ca. Yeah. But we actually have the most robust suite of innovation and entrepreneurship programming of any university in Canada.
Wow.
And our real goal is to expose as many students as we can, undergrad and graduate students, to the knowledge, skills, mindset, and resilience mm-hmm. that are needed to function in an innovation economy.
Yeah.
Right? We're in a knowledge and innovation economy now. That is the future world. You know that better than I.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what we really do a lot of training in that. And so it's a lot of fun, but we also really do help companies grow out of the university, help them learn how to help them get advice from good business mentors, from MBA classes, from scientists to help them grow their companies, because we do want more and better startups in our region as well. Yeah. And I will say we're really proud of this. NYU, New York University, did a big study globally of the most innovative cities, and they're calling it the rise of the mid-sized city, because mm-hmm. imagine you have a startup in Toronto.
Yeah.
How do you get anybody's attention, right? So, but they were only two Canadian cities made the top 50 list.
Wow.
And Halifax was one of them.
Wow.
And they said, you know, this is because of there's a huge post-secondary system here, but also DAL very specifically focuses on it. And the one other thing that we've done is our DAL Innovates programming, of course, is open to DAL students, but we recognize that the Atlantic provinces are small compared to the rest of Canada. So all our programming has always been open to anyone from across Atlantic Canada. It's not just uniquely for DAL, which is different from what most other universities do.
That's very cool. Mm-hmm. We actually have someone coming on next week, Sebastian Green, who works for the Health Sandbox.
Pulse.
And I learned
that's
a lot.
That's part of our DAL Innovates organization.
Yeah, I heard about DAL Innovates from a very engaging presentation in one of my classes. What was the class called? Seminar. It was my health class. Yeah. Anyways, this very enthusiastic guy comes in. I forget his name, sorry. But he comes in and he's just like, how old do you think most people start up a business?
Mm.
And people said like pretty young numbers. And he's like, it's actually like when you're in your 40s or 50s, when you've kind of been doing a monotonous job. And then you decide finally it's time to like start something. And I was like, huh. That's interesting. He's like, but why not start now? And I'm like, I don't know. Why haven't I started now? It's a very good movement. And I feel like it has kind of shifted my mindset a little bit, because it's an opportunity or like a path that I can go down. So it's like, should I be thinking about how to translate my research into society kind of thing? And it's
Well, it goes back to the impact, right? That's one that's one type of impact is, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, it's interesting because I think we see it quite readily with the sciences or engineering, things like that. We're really working as well on the social innovation and arts innovation. And, you know, as one of our phenomenal musicologists pointed out to me, every performer or musician who graduates from here is an entrepreneur because they have to market themselves.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, I think we're thinking about all of that as well.
That's
so
very interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's important even just to have those skills, even if you don't have an idea or, you know, a specific path you want to go down, having those skills. And then if you are 40 or 50 later in life, you already have those skills.
Exactly.
And you can go and put your ideas into practice and go into entrepreneurship. And
It always seemed like something that's like you had to have a business mindset in order to get into it. But I think it very quickly becomes, it's just you need to want it and then you can get the skills. And I really like that DAL Innovates has so many sort of workshops.
Yeah, and like the mini workshops.
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah. Classes and these different things. It's just like it helps with a lot of engagement, I think.
So. Well, and at DAL, for undergrads, you can do a minor in innovation and entrepreneurship as well.
Wow.
And we also have worked with our Faculty of Open Learning and Career Development. And we offer micro-credentials for a whole bunch of our programming as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because people, you know, you could say, look, I have a certificate in entrepreneurship.
Yeah. 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 Well, your job is sounding like one of the better jobs out there. Well, sure.
and the other part that's been absolutely fascinating for me is that, you know, I'm a health researcher, mm-hmm. and I have had the great opportunity to learn about all of our areas mm-hmm. of research. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, we're in a massive ocean university. I've learned more about ocean research and the ocean than I ever thought I would, about clean tech and lithium ion batteries, mm-hmm. about precision farming. Yep. But it is so fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's part of what I love about my job. I just
yep.
love learning about amazing research we're doing here.
Yeah. 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 I know one of my best friends and was one of my roommates for a year was in marine biology, and let me tell you, I could like say her thesis title by like heart. I knew so much about whale calls. And then she also worked on this DFO, no, not on a DFO boat. She worked on a boat that was all about putting out whale safe guidelines. And at some point I just knew like her spiel that she like gave to people. It's like, yeah. This is how far away you need to be from whales. And anyways, just by association, I've learned a lot about whales and then also fish ear bones, otoliths. I also learned a lot about that.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
That was very specific.
Very specific, yeah. not in the same exposure, but...
Maybe we should get someone on the podcast from, like, oceans research.
Yeah. Well, we did just
diversify.
It'd be great. Yeah. You know, and I'll tell you why. They just got the largest grant in the history of the university.
Yeah.
It is a Canada First Research Excellence Fund. We got $154 million from the federal government. We've leveraged that into almost $400 million to do research. And it's called Transforming Climate Action.
Mm-hmm.
And it is our ocean communities come together along with three other university partners and numerous industry partners and international partners.
Mm-hmm.
But basically the ocean is the largest carbon sink in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest part of that is the North Atlantic. So the North Atlantic absorbs more carbon than all the rainforests in the world combined.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that nobody is monitoring the carbon. So we know it's absorbing less, but nobody's monitoring it.
Hmm.
And no country has taken deep ocean carbon mm-hmm. absorption into their climate targets. They've only used land-based targets. So all the climate predictions are wrong.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
And so we're saying now you've got to monitor the ocean. You've got to look at mitigation strategies. And then we have to look at the impact on coastal communities because they're the ones the most affected. And in particular on the North Atlantic through an indigenous lens and with indigenous mm-hmm. and Inuit ways of knowing.
Wow.
So it's absolutely fascinating, but we really captured the imagination. You know, basically when we were pitching it, we said, look, it's great if you have a Canada First Research Excellence Fund in the next trend in medicine or the next, you know, trend in clean energy, mm-hmm. but none of it's going to matter if the ocean stops absorbing carbon.
Yeah.
Because we're all gone.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's it.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, so.
You can't get a better impact statement than with climate research.
Yeah.
But it is super important. And I actually know, I don't know the exact name of the program, but I know at UVic, which is where I did my undergrad, one of the professors who teaches a climate change class, Dr. Julia Baum, she just got a really big grant to start up kind of like it's a program that master's and PhD students can apply to once they're already doing research, but it helps bring together a bunch of different programs. Like, it's an interdisciplinary sort of certificate so that you can get work experience bringing climate action change to all different sectors. In so we're not just focusing on like bringing science to scientists, but also right. bringing it to other, anyways, there's like
industries.
Other industries, yeah. other
and government
departments, yeah, government workers and stuff. I think she has over 40 professors within the university who are all in different departments that are trained to take on students to have this like certificate. So anyways, I wish I knew more specifics on it, but yeah. it seems like both coasts are doing.
Yeah. And we actually, we work closely with UVic as well.
Yeah.
The issue is, I mean, they're on the Pacific and we're on the Atlantic. So when you're focusing on the North Atlantic, they do a little bit of research here and we do partner with them.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is the large, and it's, you know, colder water. It's the largest carbon sink. So it's very interesting. But I would suggest the scientific director of the Ocean Frontier Institute, Dr. Anya Waite, would be a great guest for your podcast.
Yes, we'll write that down for sure.
And she's really good at speaking about this. Mm-hmm. I've sort of given you a rough Cole's notes, but she would be a great person.
Yes.
And happy to recommend great researchers to you in all our areas, you know?
Yeah. Ah, you know what? Send them our way. Whole email list.
We have the only university partnership in the world with Tesla. Like, we have lithium-ion battery lab, right? So pioneered by Jeff Dawn, but we have Michael Metzger and Chanyin Yang, who are both working in that lab. They do great for you as well.
Beauty. You hear that, listeners? They're coming your way.
I resorted to looking at Sean's schedule and seeing who's going into his office to meet with him, and then Googling them and being like, we should have them on the research. So this is excellent, because I no longer have to do that.
Yeah. Reach out anytime. I will get you great researchers perfect. For as long as you like.
When we went to the Societal Impact, I was like writing down everyone's names, everyone's titles, and I was like, call this person, email this person.
No, happy to help with that.
Awesome.
So we were actually wondering what contributed to your decision to pursue a more like administrative role, being the VP of Research and Innovation.
Yeah. So when I started running the Institute, the CIMVR, like the Canadian Institute for Military and Veteran Health Research, when I started running that, I realized, like, I was still doing my own research, but a lot of what I was doing was actually research administration. Mm. I also became a department head at that time. I was the head of the School of Physiotherapy at Queen's. And in the military, as an officer in the military, and you're trained in administration and management of people and all of that kind of stuff. Then I worked clinically for a long time, but I managed the clinic. You know, I had some managerial experience and I really enjoyed it. And I've always loved studying leadership. I find leadership quite fascinating. As I always say, we learn from the good leaders and the bad leaders around us. We just forget to thank the bad leaders. But we learn what not to do. And so I've always had a fascination with it. And then I realized after running my institute for some time, that I really did want to contribute in a larger way to the academy broadly. Hmm. And at Queen's, I couldn't be – the next step for me after department head would have been dean. And I couldn't be the dean at Queen's. Not that that was an option. But because the School of Medicine is within the Faculty of Health Sciences, the dean has to be an MD. And so I looked around and there were a couple of deanships open that would suit me. And, you know, obviously I selected Dalvey. I was very fortunate and I got to come to Dal because I had gone here. I love Halifax. Yeah. It was really great. But I remember thinking, I was about 2 years in as an academic, and when I met our vice president, research and innovation at Queen's, and I remember saying to him, I'm going to have your job someday. Like, that's what I want to do. This is what I love. And so really and truly, I absolutely love what I do. And it's a privilege every day. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I get to work with smart people pursuing their passion. What is not to love about that? And help them get where they're going.
Right? Yeah. No, that's very inspiring for sure. Mm-hmm. I like that you saw yourself in another person's shoes and then you ended up there. You know, the most disappointing thing is when someone asks you, oh, what do you want to do? And you tell them and they're like, have you heard that's really hard to get into that role? And you're like, oh, don't you stop me.
That's what I always say. You don't know me.
Yeah. Exactly.
You
don't know
me.
It's like, this was unsolicited advice.
Well, and I have to say that vice president of research and I were still friends. He's at a different university now. And he was hugely supportive of my research role. Mm-hmm. And as was my dean. And I, you know, to this day, I remain at Queen's and I remain very good friends with both of them. And they've been really good colleagues and supporters. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it was just, it suited my skill set, but also my absolute fascination with learning about all different kinds of research,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I love my own research, but I love everybody else's too.
That's it's funny because me
that's part of why we do this podcast.
And Teresa and I, we were doing a why you should or shouldn't pursue research, and one of the topics that came up was like choosing a research topic, and both me and Teresa are like, everything that comes our way, we're like, ooh, that's very interesting.
Yeah. But that is, you know, and years ago when I was deciding when I wanted to go back to school. I knew I wanted to go back to school. And so I wrote the GMAT and I applied and got accepted to my MBA. I wrote the LSAT. I applied for law school, you know, and I applied for physio. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to someone, like, I can't decide what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, look, you just have to pick something, right? And stick with it. And you know, in my heart, I really did want to be a physio. I just didn't know if I would get in. And so when I got it, I was like, no, I believe I had already said I would start my MBA and then I canceled it and said, no, I'm going to physio. And, you know, now I'm right back there because I don't have to decide. I get to learn about all the research.
Yeah.
It's my job.
Yeah,
so,
it sounds so appealing. I feel like that kind of covers half of our next question, which is, what is your favorite part of the job? But the second part is, what's the most challenging aspect of your job?
I don't really deal so much in challenges. I prefer to frame things as opportunities.
Okay, we can do that.
Yeah, and I really think, you know, some of the biggest opportunities are staying on top of what's available globally that would help our researchers. Like, what are the funding sources we're not thinking of? Who are the partners that are real experts that we want to attract to work with DAL? And so I see that as the, you know, sort of the growth area and the opportunity area. And, you know, we're also in a province that is not a wealthy province. And so other provinces do, you know, I mean, Quebec is the exact example of how you would want a province to fund research, right? They have three agencies under one umbrella that fund research in all different areas. And we're just a less wealthy province and we don't have that kind of money to put into research. So that is a, that is something that is a bit of a challenge that we do face. I have to say that Research Nova Scotia really tries with the funding they have. They are an awesome partner. And I think generally people in the community here understand why research is important. I mean, there's just, you know, we have people who don't have houses. Like, that is a priority. Of course it's a priority, right? So, you know, you have to, I think when you come from a less wealthy province, it's that can be a bit of a challenge. But, you know, it's not a game changer because we're national and we're global, right? And
exactly, Now, I do like the shift of mindset to opportunity because if you're always – if you make that shift, then you're always thinking about what you can do next and how you can combat these challenges.
What's out there to leverage.
No, it's a good I'm keeping that in the back of my
No, it is. It is. You have to figure it out. I mean, you know, you're going to come across things inevitably. You're going to fail, right? And I always say, look, I succeed and I learn, or I learn. And you keep moving on, right? You've got to take the opportunities where you see them, and
Well, let me know if you ever write a memoir or something. I'll be wanting to read that for sure.
We were wondering what advice you would have for graduate students, maybe it be like PhDs or postdocs, that are looking to pursue non-research based roles in an academic setting.
You know, a lot of my, in particular, my team in research services have PhDs. And they really are fabulous at research administration. They get it on a fundamental level. It's an opportunity to be in an exciting environment as well. But I think, you know, not every PhD is going to go into the academy. And we keep hearing, well, you should train them for the business world or for something else. Well, guess what? Academics weren't trained to do that. So how do you train your PhD students to do that?
PhD's already long enough.
And so that's, you know, it's part of the reason I really love DAL Innovates is people can avail themselves of that programming, and you can have that mindset of how do I move out into the business community? This isn't exactly what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And look at other opportunities. And I think it's incumbent upon a university to present those opportunities to our students. So there's, you know, no education is ever a waste. Yeah. Absolutely not. And I meet people with PhDs in all kinds of amazing areas. You know, for a long time, the CEOs of pharma companies weren't people who had MBAs. It was people who had PhDs, right? Because it is a differentiator. It really is, right? And I just think there's so many opportunities that you can avail yourself of. And your PhD is, you know, it's very specific training in one area. But you do learn about all of the socio-political aspects to trying to do something new, right?
Yes.
It has to be original research.
Yeah.
And so you really learn about all of that. And that is what I found both fascinating and tough about doing a PhD, was that part of it. And I really, you know, I loved my PhD. I loved every bit of it. Except actually sitting down and writing my thesis, which was just a lot of work. But, you know, I really loved it. And, you know, I came out of there thinking, you know, I may or may not end up being an academic. I did. But, So I think I would say have an idea where you want to go, but don't miss out on opportunities because you're too focused on a single goal. Right? Look at the opportunities around you and see where you want to go.
And I feel like maybe it's shifting now, but I feel a lot of PhD students have a thought that, oh no, I can only do these three things with my PhD and other than that. And whenever people ask me, what do you want to do with your PhD? I'm like, everything. Yeah. I just like any opportunity. I just want to see what's out there. And I believe that there's a lot of opportunities out there for PhDs. And it's all about leveraging your skills that you learn throughout your PhD, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. You should look at our lab to market program.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I will.
Yes, you should, and see what you think. But one of my PhD students did it last year, and my other PhD students applied this year.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's great programming and really just good about learning what else is out there and what you can do in the world. And we've seen, you know, something, I think, incredible stuff.
Yeah, for sure. So our final question is one of utmost importance. It's from us looking at your profile on the Dalhousie website. It says that you ride a motorcycle.
I do, yeah.
And we had so many questions. we just wrote down motorcycle question mark. Is this something that you've been doing for a long time?
Yeah, I've been doing it for quite a while. Several years ago now, my husband, who has his own motorcycle, and I, and my brother-in-law and his brother rode right across Canada. We rode all the way out to the West Coast. We went out through the U.S., crossed from Tofino to Vancouver Island, Washington State to Vancouver Island, went all the way to Tofino and came right back across Canada.
Wow.
So, yeah. And that's then when we moved here, they wouldn't ship our bikes. So we had to leave a week early and drive them out here, leave them here, fly home and move.
Wow.
So,
That's very cool. So you had like a whole motorcycle gang then to go across Canada.
We had, and when we lived in Kingston, when I was at Queens, we had a really good crowd that we liked to ride with, and we go out on the weekends and ride, and it's a really fun hobby. And you know, we both ride Harleys, and
that was our next question.
And it's I mean, we meet a lot more like professionals like us than other people out there riding, but it's a lot of fun. I will say though, I really have not ridden as much since I moved here.
Okay.
We lived rurally in Kingston, so you went out right away and you were on good riding roads. We live downtown here. So we don't ride quite as much anymore, but I still have the bikes, still love it.
And that's awesome. I've met quite a few people in the last lab that I worked at. I'm pretty sure at least 5 or 6 of them all rode motorcycles. Wow. And I was just like, is this what I need? Is this what I need to do? It does sound like a lot of fun, though.
It is. And I took the course. So here's a pro tip. I took the course like they do at very NSCC will offer the motorcycle, the beginner motorcycle course if you've never ridden.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And really, you start by like pushing each other on. They have these small motorcycles and you start by pushing each other on them. Anyways, it's a great course, but it really teaches you again about road safety. Like when you've been driving for a long time and you forget. So I think everybody should have to take it because I really learned about road safety. But because it's offered at a community college, you get a T4A like for tuition. So you can claim it on your income tax.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
So there you go.
There you go. Yeah.
Next inspiration to do the course.
Yeah.
And it'll tell you, you know, it'll tell you if you want to ride or not.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll give you a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm I haven't even tried driving around Halifax yet, so we're a little bit behind right now. But like in order to get into the parking space behind my house, you have to go between like 2 really tall, skinny buildings, and like that terrifies me. And I'm like, even if I did get a car, would I be able to park it? Yeah. I don't know.
Well, thankfully in town in Hal, you don't really need a car.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's so walkable. Yeah. Everything is like 10 minutes away from where I live. It's very convenient. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but if I ever live rural, that word is so hard for me to say.
Rurally?
Yes. Maybe I'll consider a motorcycle, though I think my parents would be very, very nervous about it.
Yeah.
They're listening to this part of the episode, and they're like, yeah.
Start texting me, yeah. Well, anyways, that wraps it up for today's episode. Thank you so much for coming on as a guest today. It was so fun to learn about your journey to where you are today and your role with the military and just all the different aspects about your job. It's just so cool. Yeah. So
well,
fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much. And thank you for inviting me. I'm really honored. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, Out of Pocket with Olivia.
In Nova Scotia, it feels like no matter how accurate the weather forecast is, people are never prepared for it. Specifically, I see so many people getting in their cars to drive at times when they really should not be on the road, like in the middle of a snowstorm or immediately after a downpour of rain starts. So shout out to people who choose not to drive when the weather isn't appropriate. You don't owe anyone an explanation. Most of the time, if I'm going anywhere in the city, I'm taking the bus anyways. I've noticed since taking the bus consistently that people will get on the bus and stand in the middle of the bus for multiple stops, even if there are open seats available beside people. So, as someone who has many reasons to not be inclined to stand on the bus if avoidable, shout out to people who would rather sit beside a stranger than stand on the bus. You don't owe anyone an explanation.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And this was recorded at CKDU.